My name is Matthew O'Toole from the SEC Historical Society, and I'm here with Dick Phillips on August 6, 2002 at 2:30 p.m. to interview David Ratner, the former executive assistant to the SEC chairman. David, welcome.
Thank you, Matt.
What was your position at the SEC?
Well, I was probably had what I would consider to be the best position of the SEC, which is executive assistant to the chairman, which gives you an opportunity to be involved in everything that's going on at the commission and also an opportunity to meet all of the people there.
During what years did you serve as executive assistant?
I was there from about September of 1966 through July of 1968, which was a very exciting time.
And why did you go to work at the SEC at that time, David?
Well, it's an interesting story. I'd worked after law school. I'd worked in Wall Street for about 8 years, then started teaching at Cornell Law School in 1964, and was working on an article about voting rights in large corporations, which I eventually published in 1970. And I was wondering whether I could get some information from the SEC about large holdings in publicly held corporations. And the only people I'd worked with at the SEC when I was in Wall Street doing registration statements were some examiners and branch chiefs and maybe an assistant director or two. So I got out the CCH directory of the SEC to see if I knew anybody there in higher places. And I found under executive assistant to the chairman the name Leonard M. Lyman. And I thought, well, I knew Glenny Lyman in law school. I'll write to him and try to get this information from him. So I sent him a letter. This was early in 1966. And he wrote me back a very nice letter saying that the commission was about to get a new computer and that they hoped that they would be able to put this information together sometime soon, but at the moment they didn't have anything that would be of help to me. So I went ahead with my work, thought nothing more about it. And then at that later that year, a couple of months later, Leonny Lyman called me. Said he had been executive assistant to Chairman Cohen for 2 years and wanted to go back to his law firm in New York. And the chairman was looking for a successor and had decided he would like to have somebody from academia as his executive assistant. And so he asked whether I was interested, and I thought, well, that certainly sounds like a great opportunity.
Had you been teaching securities in law school?
I had been teaching securities. I started off in 1964 using the only book that was then available, the Jennings and Marsh. But because of my experience in Wall Street, I thought it was a great subject, and this was an opportunity to jump right into the middle of it. And so it was really solely because I chanced to have made that inquiry to Leonny Lyman that this came about. Otherwise, I'm sure he'd never have thought of me. He'd have gone to somebody else, and I'd never have had the opportunity. So I came down and interviewed the chairman and heard nothing from him for several weeks. And I called Leonny to see what was happening, and he said, well, yes, the chairman's thinking of things, but it's still alive. And eventually, the chairman decided he wanted me to come down. And so I came down and started work in the, I think it was late August or early September of 1966, which, as it turned out, was not only a very exciting time to be at the commission, but also I was very fortunate in that the commission had just moved into its new quarters on North Capitol Street, having abandoned this little rabbit warren over on 2nd Street where they'd been working for the previous 15 or 20 years.
That was the World War I temporary.
The World War I temporary. And it was really, the new building was delightful. Being the chairman's executive assistant, naturally the chairman had taken the best office for himself, which was right on the center of the 8th floor, the top floor, and I had the office next to his with a balcony outside overlooking Union Station and the Capitol. It was really very nice, and I set about settling in and finding out what it was like to be executive assistant.
So, what was it like working with Chairman Manny Cohen?
Well, it was very exciting. It was never dull. It was never easy. He was a very demanding person, a very dynamic person, And I came to him at a time when he was just really had fully recovered from a heart attack that he'd had early in his chairmanship, and which started in 1964. And so he was really trying to make up for lost time and trying to cram 4 years of achievement into 2 years of activity. He was absolutely brilliant. He just, not only was he a brilliant lawyer in the sense of making complicated legal arguments, but he knew everything about the SEC. He knew a great deal about securities law, and he had a good understanding of politics and how things work in Washington. And he was just a very dynamic, exciting person to work for. I wrote a tribute to him after he unfortunately died in 1977, in which I entitled Manny Cohen, the Bureaucrat as Entrepreneur. Even though he worked at the SEC for maybe 25 years at that time, he was not a bureaucrat. He was the chief executive officer of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which to him was in competition with other agencies to do the best possible job in regulating the fields in which it was engaged, to undertake new things, to embark on new initiatives. And it was really exciting in that sense. Now, he was difficult to work for because he had very, as I say, was very smart, had very strong opinions on things, and he did not always accept suggestions in the most welcoming manner. I viewed, since most of the people at the commission at the time, the senior officers, had been there for many years, and I was really the only person who had just come to the SEC, I figured he certainly didn't need me to tell him how the SEC worked. He knew all about that. So I conceived it as my role to suggest new ideas, new approaches, and things that maybe hadn't been thought of. It sort of turned into a routine and a pattern. I'd come up with some idea, and I would say, Dave, you spent too much time at that ivory tower up in Cornell. You don't understand. You'll never understand. And I thought I was sort of crestfallen when he said these things. But then I walk into the commission meeting a few days later, and there was Manny talking to his fellow commissioners and saying, you know, fellas, I had an idea. And I would hear my own idea coming out, maybe in somewhat modified and improved form. But then I realized Manny was listening all the time. He accepted all these things. And if he thought they had merit, he'd present them as his own, of course. But that was okay. He was the chairman. I was just there to provide him with ideas and also to serve as his liaison to other commissioners and to the staff as needed.
And you mentioned that Manny was on the staff for many years, and then he was a commissioner and then chairman. Obviously a very unusual route to become chairman of the SEC, to actually be working for the SEC for so many years. How did that affect your job, and how do you think it affected Manny when he became chairman?
Well, as I say, it affected me in the sense that unlike a new chairman coming in and getting an assistant who knew the commission thoroughly to explain it to him, it was actually the opposite. He knew the commission much better than I ever would. He knew where all the bodies were buried, who could do good work, who couldn't. So there was nothing for me to do in that field. What I could do was to suggest new things, and that's what I tried to do.
And who were the other commissioners?
Well, it was an interesting commission. The senior commissioner at the time was Barney Woodside, who actually was the most senior man at the SEC. In fact, he predated the SEC. The SEC only started in 1934, but Barney Woodside had started in the Federal Trade Commission's Office of Securities in 1933, when the 1933 Act was passed. And so he went back really all the way to before the SEC. And he had worked with Manny for many years in the Division of Corporation Finance as director. Manny was chief counsel, and then Manny succeeded him as director when he came on the commission. Manny not only respected Barney Woodside, he so loved and worshipped him. He really, and Barney Woodside was a wonderful man. I remember thinking at the time, after talking with him a few times, whenever you were talking to him, you were talking to the real Barney Woodside. He was incapable of any sham or pretense or anything else. He said what he believed. He was very cautious and conservative, and he gave Manny fits sometimes because it was hard to persuade him to go along with something. But he was also a great source of strength to Manny. Manny would often go off and just discuss it with Barney and get some sage advice on what to do. So Barney Woodside was a great tower of strength.
Were there a lot of discussions between the chairman and the commission outside of the meeting?
Manny would get together with Barney a lot. He didn't get together that much with the other commissioners to talk. He'd send me to them to tell them what he wanted them to do, or send. But with Barney, he was a close friend.
Now, those kinds of consultations between commissioners, can they be held under the Sunshine Act?
You know, one interesting thing to me, I walked into a commission. I could walk into commission meetings whenever I wanted, and if things slowed down, I'd go in there, and I noticed one day there weren't any members of the public there. So I said to Orville Du Bois, who was the secretary of the commission, I said, isn't anybody interested in these meetings? Don't they come to them? He said, oh, they're not open to the public. I said, what? Meetings of the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission are not open to the public? Oh, no, we don't invite the public. And I remember I was surprised at the time that these meetings of this government agency were not open to the public. And, of course, years later, I forget when it was, the Sunshine Act was passed and these meetings became open to the public.
The Sunshine Act also prohibit conversations between two or more commissioners outside of the commission meeting.
Right, it does. But, of course, at that time, even the discussions among them in informal meetings weren't subject to the commission. They held a lot of meetings. And I remember we were preparing some disclosure thing about how the commission works, and we drafted it, and we put in the commission meets on average 3 times a week. And the copy circulated to Barney Woodside came back with scrawled before the 3 was the word 30. In his view, the commission was meeting all the time. Manny was keeping them in constant activity. The second commissioner and 3 of the other commissioners were appointed. The 3 others were all appointed in 1964, the same year that Manny became chairman. One was Hugh Owens, a former securities commissioner from Oklahoma, very pleasant man. I'm not sure he came up with any important ideas while I was there. Another one was Hamer Budge, a former congressman from Idaho, a conservative Republican who was one of the Republican appointees, who subsequently became chairman after Manny. He had an interesting approach. He was sort of opposed to government, particularly government regulation. He felt the government was too big, and he was always interested. It was a good perspective because the orientation of most of the people at the commission was to Wall Street and the large firms. Hamer Budge was much more concerned with the small broker-dealer back in Boise, Idaho, and whether...
The Western congressman.
Yes, and whether they were being treated fairly. And I think it was an important perspective. He used to complain that the commission would take some small broker-dealer, and if he did something wrong, they'd just throw the book at him and put him out of business. And he'd say, well, why did Merrill Lynch do something wrong? Why don't you put them out of business? Shouldn't you do the same thing to the big firms you do to the small firms? And it was a different perspective, and I think it was one that was quite worthwhile.
And how did Manny Cohen respond to Commissioner Budge's points of view?
He'd generally be very polite and tolerant, and Budge made good points. I don't think Manny was as troubled by him as he was by other commissioners, because Budge basically didn't want to do too much. He was just sort of a commentator on the process. Frank Wheat, also appointed in 1964, had come from a big corporate law firm in Los Angeles, Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. Frank was a wonderful person, very dignified and very intelligent and really interested, conscientious, really wanted to do things in a in the absolutely appropriate way. In some ways, he was sort of the opposite of Manny, who was dynamic and shooting off ideas all the time. Frank was much more thoughtful and liked to consider things very carefully. But he was an important, made very important contributions to the commission. Manny, I think, tended to be somewhat suspicious of him, maybe partly because of his background in a corporate law firm. Manny felt maybe he wasn't as committed to the regulatory side of things as he might be. The other commissioner, well, that was the five at the time I came there. Barney Woodside retired from the commission in 1967, and Dick Smith, another corporate lawyer from the Davis Polk firm in New York, was appointed to replace him. Smith really got on Manny's nerves. He thought that he had an active role to play in the commission, which didn't accord with Manny's view at all. I recall Manny saying to me on more than one occasion when Dick Smith had raised that, "You go and tell Dick Smith this is my commission, and he's to do what I'm doing here. I don't want him interfering in this stuff." Well, yeah, Dick got sort of disgruntled and dissatisfied with this, and he, since he'd done disclosure work in practice, he became sort of a super branch chief. And the commission at that time had to pass on the acceleration of all registration statements, and if he found something interesting or questionable in a registration statement, he'd call up three or four members of corporation finance to come and go over it with him. I'd walk into his office, there he'd be with three members of corporation finance going over detail by detail in this registration statement, which wasn't a very constructive use of his time, but at least gave him something to do, well, since Manny wouldn't let him in on any of the important decisions.
During your tenure, David, did the commission review registration statements as a matter of course?
Not as a matter of course. They would review them if there was some issue that the staff raised. Now, or when they came up for approval, if any member of the commission had a question about them.
So all registration statements that needed an acceleration order came up to the commission. Is that correct?
You know, I'm not sure whether all of them were, I don't think the staff had to bring everything to the commission, but I think there had to be an order of the commission in each case. And I don't remember when those delegation rules came in, but at some point they delegated all that stuff to the staff, because it really was silly to have the full commission passing on each of those.
It was during your tenure that this occurred.
You know, I'm not sure when it occurred.
Okay.
And with the crush of registration statements that began to be filed during this period, and with the strength of the economy at the time, was there tension between the industry and the commission over how quickly the staff and the commission were reviewing the registration statements?
I don't think it was that much of a problem. The staff, Manny had a good deal to do with this, had always tried to set it up in such a way they could respond quickly when they were satisfied that there was full disclosure. What they would do if there was some registrant who they thought was not completely above board, they could give them a lot of trouble and hold them up for months or years even, and just not let the registration statements become effective. And I actually, in my securities casebook, which I did later, I included some egregious examples where the commission held things up for years because they just didn't think it was a good-smelling deal. But generally, they tried to accommodate the needs of what they considered the legitimate underwriters.
And who were the heads of the divisions and the offices?
Well, at this time, and I worked quite a bit with them, and right in the chairman's office, in addition to myself, there were two legal assistants, Jeff Bauman and Dick Teberg, subsequently replaced by Jerry Grossman. They did the reviewing of agenda items for the chairman and also worked on some of his speeches and other statements. So we were sort of a team working together. Corporation Finance, at that time, the director was a man named Ed Worthy, a very courtly gentleman from Virginia. But the real power in that department was his assistant director, Bob Bagley, a very conservative southerner who sort of ran the division, and sort of they'd both been there many years. a division of trading and markets, which has since been split into enforcement and market regulation, was headed by Irv Pollack, who was an absolutely wonderful guy, just the perfect public servant. I was terribly impressed with him. He just was, you know, very honest, very efficient, very dedicated. He just ran a wonderful shop. He had great loyalty from his staff. And he had an assistant director, Gene Rotberg, who was sort of in charge of the market regulation issues, which are coming up at that time, who was one of the brightest people I ever knew. It was always fun to listen to Gene Rotberg getting into a discussion with Manny Cohen and the two of them trying to outsmart the other. It was really quite a thing. And Gene had a lot to do with many of the commission initiatives in trying to deal with some of the problems in the structure of the markets. Corporate regulation, which is what investment management was then called, dealt with investment companies and also bankruptcy things, was headed by Sol Friedman, who had been there for many, many years and was also took a very conservative approach to the way things are done. I remember one time I couldn't understand why the division did things a certain way, and I said, Sol, why do you do it that way? He said, we've always done it that way. And that was often the rationale. A general counsel's office was headed by Phil Loomis, who was another absolutely brilliant person. He had a knack of being able to draft legislation or anything, just dictating it. It was an amazing gift. He dictated things, the secretary would write them up, and they came out absolutely perfect. I've never seen him. He's sort of unhealthy looking, and his hands shook, and he's always smoking cigarettes and trembling. But this, out of this pure mind would come this absolute flow of things. And Manny relied on him very heavily for any drafting or organization of stuff. I think he was in charge of the general charge of the mutual fund study and a lot of other things going on at the time. The chief accountant, Andy Barr, old Scotsman who was a real pillar of rectitude, and he really had an idea the accounting profession was an honored profession and had to be had to have the highest standards. And in light of what's going on currently, it's interesting. I recall that at that time the accounting profession was trying to get into the business of consulting. They wanted the accounting firms to be able to do consulting as well as auditing. And I remember Andy Barr standing in Manny's office saying, Mr. Chairman, this is wrong. You shouldn't allow them to do this. This is going to cause great trouble. And, you know, old Andy may have been right.
David, I get the impression, listening to you, that the division heads at that time were old-timers with many, many years of experience. In contrast, the division heads that now occupy those positions at the commission. Is that fair?
I think that's right. As a matter of fact, I think many of the people who were there at the time had come in during the time of the Depression, mm-hmm. and they knew the value of having a steady job. Mm-hmm. And I know among them, you know, they weren't about to leave. There weren't the great opportunities at that time in private practice. I mean, now the commission has turned into a revolving door. It's terribly difficult to keep people. At that time, it was difficult to get rid of them. They were going to stay there forever. And as I say, that's one reason I can see my role as coming in and making some fresh suggestions because they would drive Manny to distraction because he'd come from that background, but he'd always been innovative. And when they wouldn't do stuff, say, go down and ask Bob Bagley, where's that report I asked for? Where's the thing? And I'd go down to see Bob Bagley. And I said, Bob, the chairman wants to know where that report is. We're working on it. And if they didn't want to do it, they weren't going to do it. Manny knew that, and it frustrated the hell out of him. But, you know, they were his old friends. That was another part of it. I mean, he was very loyal to them, even at the same time he was frustrated with them. And there were some other. Harry Pollack, Irv's brother, was the personnel director. Very nice man. Wonderful person. Frank Donnerty, the controller, was sort of crusty and stuff, but very, very competent. And one of my favorites was Bill Becker, who was styled the chief management analyst, and his job was to try to improve the commissions management systems, and at that time there was a movement just started in the government with the wonderful initials PPBS, which was a program planning budgeting system. Each agency was supposed to restate its goals every year, start from zero and zero-based budgeting and do that. And it didn't completely apply to the SEC, but it certainly was a useful way of forcing agents, divisions to say, well, why are you doing it this way? Is there a better way of doing it? And Bill was always trying to improve the situation. He had a wonderful sense of humor. I remember one situation, the regional offices were divided in such a way, most of them covered whole states, but the state of Louisiana was divided, all of Louisiana east of the Atchafalaya River was under the Atlanta Regional Office, and all of Louisiana west of the Atchafalaya River was under the Fort Worth Office. And the apparent reason for this was that Bill Green, the longtime director of the Atlanta Regional Office, liked to go to New Orleans. And so he arranged that New Orleans, being east of the Atchafalaya River, would be in his territory. And so Bill Becker came up with the idea we'd start a securities firm called Atchafalaya Securities, which would be operated from a boat anchored in the middle of the Atchafalaya River, which would be outside the jurisdiction of both regional offices. We never did get it going, however.
What significant things were going on at the SEC and in the securities industry while you were there?
I would say the biggest thing going on at the commission when I first got there was the completion of the mutual fund report. Which was a commission report. The commission had received, I guess, the report of the Wharton School study of mutual funds in 1962, and then supplementary material in the special study, which was completed in 1964, with a lot of recommendations in it. And there was a fear that Manny felt there was a lot of pressure on the commission to come up with some recommendations to effectuate what was in these reports. It was a challenge to the commission, and as I said, he was very entrepreneurial. This was going to be the commission's big initiative. They would come out with this report and push through legislation.
Do you recall what the size of the fund industry was at that time was?
You know, I don't recall the numbers. I know it was nowhere near the size it is.
50 or 60 billion.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
50 or 60?
And isn't it interesting that the report was entitled Public Policy Implications of Investment Company Growth?
It is. It's fascinating because it was sort of based on the industry has grown so huge, and it's $60 billion, which is about the size of one big fund today. And the growth had caused these problems. Well, actually, there really wasn't that much wrong with the mutual fund industry. Considering the size of it, the opportunities for abuse in the mutual fund industry, my impression over the years, going all the way back to 1940 and up to the present, this has been one of the cleanest, best-running, most innovative industries in the country, and all regulated out of one small division in the SEC, unlike the banking industry, which has three federal agencies and 50 state agencies crawling all over it and has been full of problems. Well, the commission really couldn't find anything too much wrong with the mutual funds, so they focused on profits. They're making too much money. And the three sources of profit in the mutual fund business are the management fee charged for running the fund, the sales charges on the sale of fund shares, and the commissions on fund portfolio transactions. And each of these had arguably some problems which this report attempted to address. The management fees were generally based on a percentage of net assets, typically half of 1% per year. And, of course, what happened was as these grew in size, the fees became very large in the larger funds. And because of the unique structure of mutual funds, which I won't go into in detail, with their independent boards of directors, the commission sort of fastened on the idea that these directors had an obligation to go around looking for better deals on management fees, which wasn't quite the way the mutual fund industry worked. So one of the things was to do something about this high level of fees. The sales loads, the problem was particularly in Section 22D of the Investment Company Act permitted fund sponsors to fix the sales load or markup that dealers would charge on fund shares. And nobody could charge less, at least that's the way the law was interpreted. And they had, by and large, fixed it at 8.5% of the money being put into the fund. And again, this was a non-competitive situation. The argument was it could be brought down to the benefit of the public. And then on the commission rates, what had happened was the portfolio transactions were mostly handled through the New York Stock Exchange, which had fixed minimum commissions, and these fixed minimum commissions were per 100 shares. And even if it was a transaction of 10,000 shares or 100,000 shares, it was a multiple of the commission on 100 shares. And, of course, this produced just huge amounts of money, which the mutual fund industry was very imaginative in figuring out ways to dole that money out to different broker-dealers who provided them with various services. The report came out in December of 1966, and Manny was constant motion trying to get people to get the other commissioners on board. He knew that the report would have to be unanimous if he was to have any chance of doing anything, so he had to persuade all of the other four to go along. And they came up with on the management fees, they came up with this rather vague standard that the fees should be reasonable, which nobody knew quite what it meant, but that nobody could argue the fees shouldn't be reasonable. On the sales loads, my impression when I looked at it was the whole report had been written on the basis that as an argument for getting rid of this price-fixing provision and arguing sales load should be competitive. But I understand, although I didn't directly hear this, that Barney Woodside just didn't feel he could go along with that. He didn't know what the impact would be on the industry. The industry said, mutual fund shares are sold, not bought. If salespeople don't have the incentive to go out and push them, the high commission, they're not going to sell mutual funds. This industry is not going to go anywhere. And I think Barney was still concerned, maybe they're right, and we don't want to be responsible for destroying this industry. So eventually the report came out recommending, with all this stuff leading up to getting rid of fixed sales loads, and it says, therefore we recommend that there be a cap on sales loads of 5%. And where did this 5% come from? Well, it didn't really come from anywhere. People asked me afterwards, after Dick Smith had got on the commission and where the 5% came from. I said, well, the SEC has five commissioners, and each of them has five letters in his last name, and so five seems to be a pretty appropriate number. So the report came out with a recommendation of a 5% cap on sales. It was merely a throwaway for Manny to get it into legislation, because as soon as the report came out and the legislation came in, he switched it to a proposal that the NASD do a study of these and come out with a proposal, which the NASD took several years doing and eventually came out with a proposal that sales load should not exceed 8.5%, which was the figure that had been in initially. The commission rates, of course, and commission rates on portfolio transactions really wasn't handled in this report. It was sort of left to negotiations with the New York Stock Exchange over the whole question of fixed commission rates and volume discounts, which was really starting up at that time and went on for the next 7 years, culminating in the elimination of fixed rates in May of 1975.
Do you know roughly what the commission rate was fixed at?
Yeah, it was about 1%.
1%.
Yeah. And the commission did order its first cut volume discount, I think, in May of 1968.
What happened during the commission rates during your tenure?
During my time at the SEC, the commission was putting more pressure on the New York Stock Exchange, exposing these practices of give-ups and other ways of giving away all this money, and just making the commission's position untenable. Manny was also very good at getting the antitrust division of the Department of Justice involved. And they, of course, raised, well, why do you have to fix commission rates? And so the SEC could then be put in the middle as the only ones who could protect the stock exchange from the antitrust division coming in and suing them for price fixing. So Manny was very clever in positioning himself on this. And when I get back to my my second coming in Washington, that was still the center of attention. This was a really big issue. The first Buttonwood Tree Agreement, which founded the New York Stock Exchange in 1792, essentially it's a one-sentence agreement, said we, the members, agree to trade and we will charge at least 0.25% on all trades with outside people. I mean, price fixing went back almost 200 years, and that was the core of the exchange.
What were some of the other significant things that happened during your tenure?
Oh, well, I just want to go on the mutual fund thing. After the report came out, then the legislative battle began. And this was Manny nagging people at his best. I mean, he nagged them incessantly. He was nagging the White House to include the mutual fund bill in the president's State of the Union message. But it didn't get into the State of the Union message. It did, however, get a mention in the president's consumer message. And he kept going over to see the congressmen ostensibly to provide them with information they'd requested, but really to lobby them on this thing. And this was a bill which, as far as I could see, there was no real support for it, no public outcry. It wasn't really a very good bill. And I just think the only reason that bill eventually passed in 1970, these members of Congress got so tired of Manny Cohen coming after them, they said, can we give this little man something so he'll go away and stop bothering us? The thing that accomplished the most was the hearings. I think it did. The hearings on the bill did raise public awareness about two things. On the sales loads, it raised public awareness that there was no need to pay 8.5% because there were some other funds which are sold without a load, and you could get those. And once people learned about mutual funds and that they were good and you could get them without paying the 8.5%, that gradually began to crumble. And over a period of, the decade after that time, a lot of the big fund managers just dropped their sales loads and started distributing on a no-load basis, like Fidelity and Vanguard and others. So much more than the actual legislation, the hearings provoked this public awareness. The other thing it provoked is public awareness of is something Manny and the commission did not intend. Manny wanted to get some economists in there to talk about the high management fees. And he got, I think Paul Samuelson from MIT testified in the House, and Henry Wallach from Yale testified in the Senate. And this was the beginning of work on the so-called random walk hypothesis, or as it came to be known, the efficient market theory. And essentially what they were saying is, regardless of what you say about these management fees, management really isn't worth anything, because we've done research which shows that you can do just as well by throwing darts at the stock tables and picking the stocks on which the darts land. And Wallach actually testified this before the Senate subcommittee. And the Senator McIntyre, who was sort of in the pocket of the banks, so he was sort of trying to cause trouble for the mutual fund people, decided to have a little fun with this. And so at the next meeting of the Senate Securities Subcommittee, he came in and reported that he had in fact gone and bought a New York Times and some darts and had thrown it at the the stock tables, and the stocks that it hit had wound up outperforming the average mutual funds over this period. Well, this was, I think the SEC was almost outraged as the industry was by this, because the SEC, this is a solemn profession, these are professionals, they hold to high standards, and say all they're doing is just playing games. But what this led to, of course, was one of the great phenomena of mutual funds, the index fund. And the index fund has been enormously successful because it provides you with diversification, which is really what you get a mutual fund for, at very, very low cost. It had that effect. One incident of the fight over sales loads, when I was sitting in the House hearing the audience when Samuelson testified about that competition was the way to go, and behind me was sitting two old mutual fund executives. and one of them leaned over to the other, as Sam talked about free competition, said, "That man belongs in Moscow." It was so funny. That. Anyway, the other things that were going on. The other big legislative matter, and this was not something started by the SEC, was takeover bids. Senator Williams of New Jersey had introduced a bill to regulate hostile takeovers. And this was not at the SEC initiative, because this was really designed to protect corporate managements from being taken over rather than protect shareholders. And so the SEC's concern was to improve their position in this legislation, which, of course, was submitted to the SEC for its views. And the SEC attempted to use the provisions in there on corporate repurchases to increase their own power to regulate corporate repurchases, which was a source of some possibilities of manipulation. The commission had brought an action against Georgia-Pacific a couple of years before on that. And they wanted to get a provision in there giving the SEC broad powers to regulate repurchases by corporations of their own shares. And they got some language in. And one day I was called over to a meeting in the office of Congressman Hastings Keith of Massachusetts, who was the ranking Republican on the subcommittee. And I came in there, and he introduced me to a lobbyist from Sears Roebuck who was there, who, in effect, had said, no way, we don't want the SEC regulating corporate repurchases unless it's to prevent fraud. And so the language was changed to make it only to prevent fraud. The takeover bid bill, which, again, I don't think it really accomplished too much, was signed the day I left the SEC in July of 1968. Most of the action really took place under state law, particularly Delaware law, in these takeover battles. Two things were interesting. One thing it did was, in Section 13D, it required reports by every person or entity that held more than 5% of the stock of one of these large companies, which, of course, was the information I'd been looking for when I went to the SEC in the first place. So they finally got provisions for it the day I left. The other provision I'm particularly fond of is Section 14F of the 1934 Act, which I actually suggested. I'd been working on these matters of friendly buyouts, where a company, where the holders of a controlling block of stock would sell the stock to a new holder, and all the directors would be replaced without any vote of shareholders. And I felt this sort of violated basic rules of corporate democracy, and I suggested a provision to be added to require that these be put to a vote of shareholders. And Manny referred it to Phil Loomis, who said, well, he didn't think the commission really could take that sort of substantive view, but that a provision requiring disclosure of the same type as if there were an election of directors would be appropriate, and that was indeed put into it.
And that was the origin of the Section 14 information statement.
No, the information statement was in the 1964 amendment. That's 14C.
Okay.
But this is an analogy to 14C, which says, in effect, even if you don't have an election of directors, you've still got to provide the same information when you replace them. 14C said if you don't solicit proxies because you have a majority of shares. So it really was sort of expanded on the idea
of
the extension of 14C.
On that note, let's pause for a moment. Significant things that were going on at the SEC and the securities industry at this time.
One very important thing in the disclosure area that started at the SEC at this time was the beginning of the idea of integrating the disclosure requirements of the 33 and 34 Acts. Milton Cohen, who directed the special study, had gone up to teach at Harvard for a year, and having nothing to do there, he just had time to create all this mischief, so he wrote an article in the Harvard Law Review called Truth in Securities Revisited, in which he made the very sensible point that it was merely sort of a historical accident that the 33 Act and 34 Act had two different schemes of disclosure, and if you were designing a rational system, you put the two together. And he persuaded people at the American Law Institute that this was a sufficiently important idea that they should undertake a study of how they could change the law to accomplish this result. Sometime in 1967, a delegation came to call on Manny, consisting of Milton Cohen, Ray Garrett, who was a big figure in the American Law Institute, and of course who was later chairman of the commission in 1973, and Louis Loss, the professor at Harvard Law School, the author of the major treatise on securities law. And Manny invited Dick Phillips and me to sit in the meeting, and at which they announced that they were going to ask the American Law Institute to start drafting this new code, which would integrate these disclosure requirements of the two acts. After they left, Manny expressed his concern, if this thing gets into legislation and goes to Congress, who knows what will come out. If it's not a time of major public upset, they might weaken all the requirements. And Dick and I suggested to him, well, you know, Manny, the commission could do a lot of what they want by rulemaking and just use the rules and forms to integrate the disclosure requirements of the two acts. He said, well, yeah, this might be a good idea. And we added the person to do this would be Frank Wheat, who had expressed a lot of interest in this thing in the past. Well, this sent Manny off into muttering, Frank Wheat, oh, God, phony liberal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so we left Manny. And a few days later, he called us back. And there he was sitting with Bob Bagley. I told you, a very conservative assistant director of corporation finance. And Manny said, well, Bob, I was thinking about your idea, and I've asked Bob Bagley to do a study of this and to recommend changes in our disclosure requirements. So we waited till Bagley left, and then Manny, you know, that's not, Bob Bagley is not the solution. He's a big part of the problem. Frank Wheat's the guy to do it. So Manny sputtered and expostulated some more. And I walked into a commission meeting about a week later, and there's Manny talking to his colleagues and saying, well, I had this visit from these guys who are going to do this legislation, and I'm really troubled about it. I think we can do this in the commission and do a better job. And I've asked Frank Wheat to head this study, and he's graciously consented. So he did. Dick Phillips worked closely with Frank on the study. They did a wonderful job. They came out with good recommendations, which enacted over a period of about 10 years, culminating with the adoption of the integrated disclosure requirements in 1982, Regulation SK, really did the job. In the meantime, the ALI went on with its plan to redo the securities laws, and the project just got way out of hand. Louis Loss decided he would rewrite all the federal securities laws. And this thing just turned into a monster project. The ALI spent 9 years doing it. They finally came and ceremonially presented a giant volume to the leaders of Congress in 1978, and nobody would even introduce it. People in Congress looked at this thing and said, oh, my God, this would tie us up for years. There's no public interest in this thing, whatever. So it, as it turned out, the Wheat Report basically solved the problem, and the commission's rules and that were enacted pursuant to it. A lot of stuff, of course, was going on in the securities industry at this time. The institutionalization of the market, this process by which most of the people holding stock and trading in the markets were large institutions, particularly the mutual funds and pension funds, creating pressures on trading practices, commission rates, and so forth. And Manny decided the commission needed to do a study of the institutionalization of the markets. And he got Congress to authorize such a study, I think it was in May of 1968. So the study actually started, I think, basically after Manny had left the commission and Budge had become chairman. Because the people in the industry had been burned by the special study, which was headed by lawyers and uncovered a lot of very dubious practices, Manny had to guarantee it was going to be an economic study conducted by economists. And it was an economic study conducted by, headed by two economists, Don Farrar and Cy Smith, And I think they finally came out with 1971, totally worthless. It had nothing. It was masses, giant masses of figures, no organization to it, almost impossible to make head or tail of anything in it. It was an economic study, and as such, was didn't do any good. But the what was also happening about this time, in 1968, was the development of a really serious problem in the security industry, the back office problem. Volume was increasing enormously, and at that time, the method of clearing and settling transactions was to transport 100-share certificates in briefcases and wheelbarrows and stuff around Wall Street from one firm to another. And at this time, volume was increasing. It was getting up to, 10, 15 million shares a day. And this was really beginning to create problems. And firms were losing track of their inventories of stock. You imagine today, regularly every day, the NYSE and NASDAQ between them trade 3 to 4 billion shares of stock. If you can imagine transporting 100-share certificates around Wall Street covering 3 billion shares of stock, you'd imagine what would happen. Well, unfortunately, when this problem really hit was after Manny had been let go. When Nixon was elected in 1968, Manny sort of lobbied a bit that he was really a nonpartisan person and that Nixon could continue him in office comfortably. Nixon had campaigned against heavy-handed government regulation, and as far as he was concerned, Manny was about the heaviest hand around, and he was out by, I think, March of 69. And Nixon appointed Hamer Budge in his place as chairman. And that turned into a real disaster for the commission, because Hamer Budge, as I said, really didn't believe in big government or regulation. And he wouldn't ask for larger budgets or more assistance of the commission. He was suspicious of the staff. And I remember I left the commission by this time and meeting and getting letters and talking to friends at the commission. Morale just dropped. People were just terribly discouraged. The commission went into a terrible funk, which lasted the next couple of years while things were really going to hell on Wall Street. The paperwork crisis, which was a product of too much volume, was succeeded by a sharp decline in prices and volume, which put financial pressure on the firms. Several of the largest firms went out of business. The stock exchange and the other firms are desperately going around trying to prevent Wall Street from collapsing completely. It was undoubtedly the biggest danger to hit Wall Street since the collapse in 1929 and the Great Depression. I mean, the scandals that are going on today are nothing compared to what was happening in Wall Street in 1969 and 70.
And what significant things were going on in the United States and in other parts of the federal government while you were at the SEC?
Well, of course, the big thing that was going on was the Vietnam War. This is 66 to 68, and the country was falling apart. I sometimes had the feeling we were here dealing with these securities issues as though this was the be-all and end-all, the mutual funds. Well, the country was falling apart. There were riots in the streets. The country was a real mess. And I particularly recall I was my last year there in the spring of 1968, when you had the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. And the day after the assassination of Martin Luther King, I went out on the balcony of my office. Actually, it was the other side of the building facing west, and looked and could see the smoke rising from 14th Street in Washington, where the mobs had rioted and were burning all the buildings. This was pretty frightening stuff. The commission, of course, of government offices were closed. I joined this gridlock of traffic trying to get out of the city. It was really a very frightening feeling. So, you know, what we were doing at the SEC was, it was off in a corner. What was really going on was the country was going through an enormous crisis. And, of course, that crisis, it really lasted from the assassination of John Kennedy in 1963 to the resignation of Richard Nixon in 1974, a period of 11 years during, I don't think the country has gone through any comparable turmoil since the Civil War. So that was sort of the backdrop against we were playing these little parts in the SEC.
How do you think it affected the SEC's work at the time?
Well, I think in a way, of course, it eventually affected the SEC because Lyndon Johnson decided not to run again. Richard Nixon was elected. He appointed Hamer Budge, and that had a great impact. I don't think the Vietnam War didn't really have a direct effect on the SEC's operations.
Do you think it had an effect on funding?
It probably did. I mean, just as the SEC was sent to Philadelphia during World War II because it was considered a totally non-essential agency, the government, Lyndon Johnson had many other things to worry about other than high sales loads on mutual funds. And so the SEC just wasn't very important in the scheme of things. But I think the thing that impacted that was the fact that Hamer Budge didn't ask for money. Manny would have bugged them until he'd gotten some money out of them.
And these sorts of issues led you to leave the SEC then?
Oh, no. That had nothing to do with my leaving the SEC. I had gone there for a fixed term. I'd taken a limit on my leave of absence from Cornell was 2 years. I had to go back or lose my faculty position there. And I had the idea, if I like Washington, I'll stay. But I find I like to take a long-term perspective on things, which one can do in teaching. And in Washington, just as in Wall Street, everything is what happened 10 minutes ago and all this stuff and pressure and things. And I just, it was fun and exciting to do for a period of time, but I wasn't going to stay in an administrative position forever. So I left as scheduled in July of 1968 and to go back to my teaching at Cornell.
And after your teaching at Cornell, what other sorts of positions did you have then in Washington?
In July, Manny was gone, was he not?
No. Manny didn't leave until March of 1969. Mike Eisenberg came in and succeeded me as executive assistant for the last 8 or 9 months. Well, two interesting things that happened. First, right after I left the SEC, the first thing I did was my wife and children and I took a holiday in Europe. We went to visit relatives in London, my father in Spain, and on the way stopped to visit my best friend from law school, Ed Coughlin, who had gone several years before to work for Bernie Kornfeld's mutual fund operation in Geneva, which of course had been a target of SEC proceedings for years and years. And so the first night we got to Geneva, Ed installed us in an apartment owned by one of the IOS executives who was out of town at the time, and took me to a party at a chateau I think was rented by Jimmy Roosevelt, the son of FDR, who was one of the people on the board of IOS at the time, Investors Overseas Services. Well, this party was something. I mean, they were really flying high, and this mansion just... the food and the Bernie Kornfeld with his two pet ocelots and Jimmy Roosevelt, Pat Brown, the former governor of California, was on the board, Eric Mendy, the former chancellor of West Germany. I mean, this thing was really incredible. And Ed took me around, introduced me to everybody. It's my old friend Dave Ratner. He works for Manny Cohen at the SEC. Well, cough up their canapes or whatever they were eating. It's like, Pat Brown haranguing me endlessly about how the SEC had no jurisdiction over us. We're doing business abroad. They have no business coming after us. It was a wild evening. Well, a few years later, of course, IOS collapsed in flames. It was taken over and looted by Robert Vesco, and all sorts of other horrible things happened. But it was an interesting experience. So, as I say, I went back to Cornell, started teaching in the fall of 68, and then a few months later, Budge replaced Manny as chairman of the commission, and the industry began to fall apart. And by the end of 1970, Congress realized something had to be done. I mean, this was really a serious crisis. And both houses of Congress authorized studies to determine what had happened and what should be done. And I actually was invited to go and interview with both of them. The Senate study was headed by Senator Harrison Williams of New Jersey, who subsequently came to a sad end with respect to the Abscam scandal. And the House study was headed by John Moss of California, who was a subcommittee of the Commerce Committee. And I interviewed them, and it sounded like another very interesting project. As a matter of fact, my entree to the Senate study was a guy named Steve Paradise, who had worked at the SEC and then had gone to work for Williams as his man on securities. And Steve was a very political, manipulative person, and he could really work out deals. And it looked like a good time to go and do something in Congress, because it looked like the SEC was totally out of the picture. So Budge wasn't going to do anything. He really was incapable of taking any strong action. So I considered the offers from both of them. I decided, the House will probably have better hearings, but the Senate will do the deals and write the bills, which is what had happened on the takeover bids. And so I went with the Senate committee, and I was absolutely right. The House held wonderful hearings, but they couldn't pass anything. And the deals were made in the Senate, and that was the legislation that eventually passed. John Moss,
that legislation was what?
That was the Securities Act amendments of 1975. Okay. Which sort of dealt with a range of supervisory things. But again, as I'm going to say, the important thing was not the legislation that resulted from it, but the effect of the hearings themselves. I remember John Moss had a great way of antagonizing the people on his subcommittee. So I think it was Congressman Stuckey from Georgia, he said, John Moss introduced a resolution honoring motherhood, we'd vote against it. And whereas Williams knew how to, Steve Paradise knew how to put things together. So in late 71, I headed down to Washington again, I guess in the summer of 71, to work on this thing. And something unexpected happened. Hamer Budge resigned and was replaced by a man named William J. Casey, a tax lawyer from New York who subsequently went on to even greater notoriety as head of the CIA. And he came in, and it was like a whirlwind. He was in some ways like Manny. He was very aggressive, dynamic. Were you still at the... You'd left the commission by the time Casey came in.
Meaning Dick Phillips.
Yes. Yeah. And he had quite an impact on the commission, I think some good impacts and some bad impacts. He really shook things up. He brought in a lot of new people, many of whom were very talented, were from the private sector, and they did do this job of rethinking a lot of stuff the commission had done before. Casey was a venture capitalist, and his idea was, we should require people to disclose the same kind of stuff as venture capitalists need, which made sense. And he was always big at pushing projections of earnings as a thing. That's what people want to know, not what you earned last year. You want to know what you're going to earn next year. So, but the effect, as far as we were concerned, on the Senate study was the SEC was suddenly front and center. Casey was just like Manny in the sense that he wanted to be the center of attention, and he wanted the SEC to do this thing. So we were constantly battling with Casey. And, of course, the two houses of Congress were controlled by Democrats. Casey was a Republican chairman, and so you added the partisan things to the turf battle. Well, working on that study, and I stayed there for over a year and a half, was also a very interesting experience, with also many frustrations and times when I just wanted to leave and pack it up and go back home. Working with Steve Paradise was difficult. Working in the political milieu was difficult. But we did manage to put a very good staff together. Each senator on the subcommittee got to make one appointment. Senator Stevenson of Illinois, Adlai Stevenson, appointed a very good young Chicago lawyer named Al Harris. I didn't get along very well with him, but he was very capable. Senator from Oregon appointed a guy named Ken Stevens, who did a wonderful job analyzing the breakdown in the back office and what needed to be done in that area. One of my former students from Cornell called me one point and said he was tired of his job in New York. Could he come down and work on the study? And by that time, we sort of run out of political appointments. And so he came, Tom Newkirk, who's still, after working on that study, went to the SEC, where he's still associate director of the Division of Enforcement. My favorite appointment story, though, was Steve Paradise walked in one day and during the summer of 72 and said that we had to hire the son of the mayor of Bayonne, New Jersey, for the summer. And he said, I told the senator we're going to be a laughing stock with hiring the mayor's son for this study. And I said, no, you got to do it. You got to do it. So he's coming in, you know, next week. Find something for him to do. And I thought, well, what the hell are we going to do? So in walked the applicant. Well, in the meantime, Senator McIntyre, who I had mentioned in the other connection of the mutual funds, had an interest in oil and gas drilling programs and wanted us to study those. Well, it really had nothing to do with the subject of our study, so I thought, well, we'll get this kid from Bayonne, New Jersey in and have him do the work on the oil and gas drilling programs, and then that'll be fine. Well, so in came Harold Fitzpatrick, the son of the mayor of Bayonne, New Jersey, and turned out he couldn't stay the whole summer with us because he'd just completed his first year at Harvard Law School and was invited back to join the Harvard Law Review. And so I said, well, okay, we've got a sort of a short-term project here you could help us with. Do you know anything about oil and gas drilling programs? He said, well, last summer I worked in the oil investment department at Chase Manhattan Bank, and I worked on all these oil drilling deals. I said, Harold, sounds wonderful. Perfect, you know, he knew everything about these things. And so at the end of it, he said, well, now, if I get any problem on this, who's the expert on Capitol Hill and oil and gas drilling programs? I said, Harold, you're the expert on oil and gas drilling programs. I learned a lesson from that. If we had scoured the country looking for this person to do a study of oil and gas drilling program, we could not have done better than the son of the mayor of Bayonne, New Jersey. So you learn some lessons on these things. Well, what did we do in that study? We focused, obviously, on the operational problems because that was the crucial thing. And what you had at that time, the banking industry, which handled the transfer agent functions and depository functions, and the securities industry, which handled the actual transfer certificates, just pointing fingers at each other and blaming the other one for the mess. So they came up with a committee called BASIC, Banking and Securities Industry Committee, to try to work these problems out, which operated very slowly. As a matter of fact, some people said BASIC stood for Bureaucratic Attempt to Stifle Innovation and Change. And actually, Ken Stevens' report, which came out in the first installment of our report in February of 1972, was absolutely the best thing done on clearing and settlement. And it really laid out what the problems were. People really got to work. They came up with Depository Trust Company, set up as a New York bank. They dumped all these securities into a vault in downtown New York, and there they've sat ever since. And it solved the problem. It was easy to solve in a practical sense. It was just difficult to solve politically. The other big issue, which, of course, was heating up, was the complex of issues around commission rates. And the commission, the SEC, had already started to put pressure on the stock exchange for volume discounts and having competition at the upper levels. And we just added to the pressure. We just held hearings, the House held hearings, on how all the distortions introduced into the markets, how transactions were being sent to out-of-the-way exchanges solely for the purpose of giving up part of the commission to different groups of broker-dealers. It was impairing the efficiency of the markets. And we just added to the pressure. And it was part we also focused on how you develop the thing which still hasn't been developed, the so-called central market system, which is combining all these different markets. We focused on the self-regulatory system and suggested changes in the SEC's oversight functions over those, and the application of the antitrust laws. And again, most important thing that happened there, both of which happened in 1975, the less important one was the passage of legislation which did change the SEC's role in a number of ways and rationalized a number of things. The main thing was it finally brought pressure to bear on the New York Stock Exchange, which eliminated fixed commissions on May 1st, 1975. I think there are a lot of people in the industry who really thought the markets wouldn't open for business that day. The commission, fixed commission rates were so ingrained in it. I think it was Fred Cecil who did that calendar of May 1st, 1975 and all these weird things that would happen when they opened for business. But of course, what happened was the commission cost per transaction went way down and the number of transactions went way up, so that the securities industry is making much more money now than they ever did on the fixed commissions. And you know, it's obvious once it was done that it was the right thing to do. And ironically, the case, private litigation against the New York Stock Exchange, alleging that their price fixing was a violation of the antitrust laws, finally reached the Supreme Court in 1975. And the Supreme Court, after commission rates had been abolished and the fixed commission rates had been abolished, held that the stock exchange was not subject to the antitrust laws and the fixing of commission rates, because the commission, as evidenced by its actions, had been taking care of the problem and had ended.
That was a doctrine of primary jurisdiction.
Pardon?
That was a doctrine of primary jurisdiction.
I'd say, yeah, it was. But it was sort of wrote in a fitting end. They couldn't, had the issue still been pending, I think the Supreme Court decision might have been different. But since the problem was eliminated, they could be gracious and say, well, you're not subject to the antitrust laws. So, now, what happened at the SEC, as I say, Hamer Budge really caused a sad decline. Bill Casey really revitalized the commission, brought in a lot of new ideas. He was somewhat ethically challenged, I would say. He really operated on the margins and could get away with anything, but he was very clever. And the extent of his cleverness became obvious when he left in 1973, to head the Central Intelligence Agency. Nixon appointed a guy, Brad Cook, from Chicago in his place, and within 2 months, Cook was in the middle of a scandal of having changed an SEC report to eliminate references to Vesco's contributions to the Nixon reelection campaign, and was forced to resign in disgrace, which led to Nixon attempting to salvage the situation, appointed Ray Garrett as chairman and Al Sommer as a member of the commission in 1973, joining, I think, Irv Pollack, Phil Loomis, and John Evans, who'd come from the Senate Banking Committee. I've always thought that commission from 73 to 75 was maybe one of the best assemblages of the people ever to run the SEC. I mean, five people of great integrity, intelligence, really dedicated. I mean, but Garrett, Sommer, Pollack, and Loomis, I mean, you couldn't ask for better people to run the commission. And I believe Al Sommer, in his interview, talked about how he had to persuade Ray Garrett to go ahead with the elimination of fixed commission rates. Now, one of the other things that both my work at the SEC and the work with the Senate Committee led to my being asked to do casebooks on securities and institutional investors, which I did.
Please pause.
In addition to these casebooks, which I've done, which I've got a great deal of pleasure from, as a matter of fact, the one I've got the most pleasure from is securities regulation in a nutshell. I really enjoy making things clear and easily understandable to people. When I was at the commission, I was always trying to get people to express things clearly. I remember rewriting one whole release that came out of the Division of Corporation Finance, where they had done an investigation, and he was announcing the results of this investigation, all written in a turgid way that made it completely unintelligible to anybody reading it. And so I really enjoy making things understandable to people. I also wound up doing a number of CLE programs, including one that I was asked to do in 1973 at Haverford, Pennsylvania. Dick, you were on the fourth week of that, I think, dealing with investment companies. A four-week program on federal securities law. Nobody ever tried that before or again. It was much too long. But anyway, we did it, and as luck would have it, the first week of the program was on disclosure, and two of the people I had on the panel were Ray Garrett and Al Sommer. And it was while they were at Haverford participating in this program that their appointments as chairman and a member of the Securities and Exchange Commission were announced. And that was great timing. The highlight of the second week, which was on enforcement and fraud and things, we had one panel with Stan Sporkin, who by this time had become head of the Division of Enforcement, and Art Matthews, a wonderful lawyer who sadly died young, who had already left the commission and gone to Wilmer Cutler and Pickering, where Manny Cohen was. And they were discussing the rights of people in SEC enforcement proceedings. And Art was stating the line a lot of lawyers in private practice said, that the SEC didn't always give due process to people who were the subjects of these proceedings. And he was going on about this idea of the necessity of due process. And Stan Sporkin was sinking lower in his seat and looking grumpier and grumpier as this went on. And finally, he couldn't stand it any longer. He said, "Art, you keep talking about due process this and due process that. Due process is for innocent people. We're dealing with crooks." Well, people in the audience, their jaws dropped. They couldn't believe that Stan Sporkin had said this. And after I went out of the room, after the program, one of the students in the course came up to me and said, "Professor Ratner, let me show you something." And he took me into the men's room. And there, in crayon on the wall above the urinal, somebody had written, "Sporkin has spoken." It was a great summary. Anyway, I had a lot of fun with all of this stuff, and it was a delightful part of my life.
Thank you, David. Any other memories or thoughts that you'd like to share with us as we part?
Well, I think I've covered pretty much everything. As I say, the problems of today, they're certainly serious ones. There probably are ways in which the SEC might have been more aggressive. It's very difficult, though. The SEC supposedly has power to regulate all these things, and Congress expects it to do all these things, but unless the political will is there, it's very hard to do it, and the Congress will just call the SEC in. So you really have to wait for a scandal, and then you usually do the wrong thing. Just one last story, one interesting episode on the relationship between the SEC, which because it's an independent agency, Congress feels that it really has jurisdiction over it. While I was there, Manny was called on by the Senate Committee on Small Business to testify, because there were always complaints from small business organizations that the SEC rules made it very difficult for them to raise money. The chairman of the committee was Senator Montoya of New Mexico, and ranking Republican was Senator Javits of New York, and Manny was there ready to testify on what the SEC was doing to make the burdens easier. And Javits said to Montoya, "Mr. Chairman, I have to leave for another meeting. Would you permit me to make a statement first?" And Montoya said, "Certainly, Senator Javits, you make a statement." Well, Javits proceeded to give a 5-minute statement tearing the SEC up and down for its bureaucratic rules and its stifling of small business. And, "Hey, Mr. Cohen, you've got to reform your agency and do something about this and stuff." And then he finished and said, "May I be excused, Mr. Chairman?" Montoya said, "Certainly." Javits came down off the dais, came up to the witness table, shook Manny's hand, said, "Good to see you, Manny." And then I realized what the relationship is in between people and agencies and government is not always what it appears to be. Having the opportunity to be there on the inside just gave me a great, great insight. It was a wonderful opportunity.
Well, on that note, this interview is completed, and the Society thanks you, David Ratner and Dick Phillips, for an enlightening and entertaining interview. Thank you.
Thank you.